The Guardian.
Welcome to another episode of Science Weekly Extra. We're taking some of the most pressing scientific questions about the coronavirus outbreak, some sent in by you, and exploring them in detail. We'd love to keep hearing from you, so please continue to send your questions via a form we've set up. Head over to theguardian.com/COVID-19 questions, all one word. In today's episode, we'll be looking at something that listener Rebecca Gayton asked about, social distancing. It's become a bit of a buzzword, but what is it? How effective is it? And how might it help us to flatten the curve?
So by reducing our number of contacts, we can try and reduce the probability that both we will acquire the infection and also the probability that I would then pass it on to somebody else.
I'm Ian Sample, and this is Science Weekly Extra.
Deirdre, hi, can you hear me? It's Ian here.
Hi, sorry about
Wonderful.
The delays.
Wonderful, I can hear you, and there's a beautiful wave of your voice that comes over on the system as well.
Before we jump in, some of you may have noticed that things sound a little different today. And that's because, like many of you, we'll soon be working from home. But we want to keep the series going, and so we're currently testing out ways in which you might be able to do that. So please do forgive us if the sound isn't quite as good as usual. Back to today's show. This is Deirdre Hollingsworth.
My name is Deirdre Hollingsworth. I'm a professor at the Big Data Institute at the University of Oxford, and I'm an infectious disease modeller.
Deirdre, we've heard a lot recently about flattening the curve. What does that mean?
So in this context, it means trying to make the peak incidence or peak demand really on beds in the NHS flatten out so the peak is later and wider and you're sort of spreading that demand. It also results in lower total numbers of people usually requiring healthcare, but the main policy aim would be to reduce peak demand on the health service and spread it out.
So the idea being that if we do nothing about any epidemic really of or an infectious disease that comes along, you will typically get this exponential growth in cases early on and a high peak that then falls down simply because there are fewer people left to infect, who don't have either immunity or aren't already infected. So the idea is broadening that curve out, but as you do that, sort of dampening it down as well. Is that right?
Yes. If you have a completely unconstrained epidemic, then the reason it kind of goes up and comes down again, the reason it comes down is because if you're one of those people who are infected at that time, most of your contacts will already have been infected. And therefore, the number of people that you can infect is not that many. And so that's why the epidemic starts to die out.
Take us through again some of the benefits of doing this. So your key aim, I suppose, one of the key benefits is just that you have fewer people, that small percentage of people who really end up in trouble with really severe disease from this infection. You minimize that number going into the healthcare system and so reduce your chances of overwhelming our capacity.
Yeah, and this is why pandemics are very different from any other sort of infectious disease that we normally deal with. There's no immunity in the population. And so potentially the whole community is at risk. Not everybody will get infected in any outbreak, but potentially there's large swathes of the community at risk and their contacts are also at risk. And therefore, you know, you could potentially have very large numbers of people who could become very ill. And that's why you need to manage that process.
So what are some of the most effective ways we can do this, Deirdre?
So infectious diseases are spread through contact between individuals. So the fact that we're doing this podcast online means that I'm unlikely to spread an infectious disease to you. But if we were doing it in person and I was infected with any kind of respiratory virus, there would be some chance that I would spread it to you. So by reducing our number of contacts, we can try and reduce the probability that both we will acquire the infection. So if I don't meet anybody today, I can't acquire an infection from them. And also the probability that I would then pass it on to somebody else.
And there must be some sort of key factors or properties of the virus or other social factors that determine how effective social distancing measures are. What sort of things come into play?
That's a good question. I think we don't fully understand for this particular coronavirus yet what are the main drivers of transmission. So one of the concerns with these types of viruses is that perhaps healthcare workers, for example, could be at high risk because they're treating very sick individuals. Or it could be that you have to live in a household with someone and have repeated exposure over a day or two before you would be likely to transmit to that person. We know that droplet transmission is important, but we're not so sure about, I think, the role of sort of contact. So if you were shedding virus in a house and then I came in after you'd gone, what would be my risk of acquiring that virus? I think that's more uncertain.
And is there anything we need to think about in social distancing around the possibility, and I don't know how well it's nailed down yet, of pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission?
So there was evidence early on from China that where they had individuals who were, so for example, they had a case and then they looked at the people who were contacts of that case. And sadly, some of those individuals were infected and they took samples from those individuals before they started to show symptoms. And they found that there was some virus shedding a day or two before people showed symptoms. So that's sort of some hard biological evidence. There's also an epidemiological signature because the incubation period, which is from when you get infected until you show symptoms, seems to be roughly around 5 days. There's obviously variability around that. But the epidemic growth rate, the doubling time, so the time if you go from 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 cases, etc., seems to be around 4 to 7 days. And those two things together mean that you must have pre-symptomatic infection of some kind. And the estimates are varying. There's some estimates around sort of 20%, some as high as 50%. And that pre-symptomatic infectiousness makes control of infectious disease much more difficult. There's a very good paper by Christoph Fraser in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences called Factors That Make an Infectious Disease Controllable. I think it's from about 2004, in which he really lays out the theory, which says that R naught, which is the average number of people that each infectious individual infects, is a really important driver of how controllable a disease is. But another really important factor is how much transmission occurs pre-symptomatically or asymptomatically. So mild cases who may not even notice that they're infected. If there's a large proportion of that pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission, then things like contact tracing, isolation of symptomatic cases are important things for slowing the epidemic, but you're not going to control the epidemic solely through those types of measures.
How important is the timing of introducing social distancing measures? Are there dangers if you go too early, too late? How does it work?
So theoretically, infectious disease modellers like myself have thought about this in sort of a situation where you know everything about transmission. So if you think you can eradicate an infectious disease, then the earlier you do it and introduce, you know, really strong measures, the earlier you do it, the better, because then you've got less kind of infections to stop and curtail. But if you think there's a risk of resurgence, then you might consider, in a sort of a theoretical model, sort of leaving it a bit later and sort of managing demand as you start to get towards your peak demand for intensive care units. So like if you're driving a car and you're parking your car, you kind of brake towards hitting the wall and you don't hit the wall. But that really requires an awful lot of knowledge about what's going on, and that you're not, you know, you don't want to be surprised by the wall suddenly being a lot closer to you than you were expecting. So, you know, theoretical models say that you can start a bit later and manage the demand in that way. But in reality, do you ever have enough information to do that is the question.
If you do social distancing and you achieve this flattening of the curve, do you not then have to worry about resurgence of infections on the other side? Have you already sort of taken care of that danger?
So again, the theory would say if you sort of manage the epidemic through the social distancing, if you don't completely stop transmission, that you could, in theory, have enough herd immunity when you start to lift your social distancing, that the second peak would be sort of a similar height. But that, again, requires quite a lot of fine tuning and quite a lot of knowledge about the epidemic. So we wrote a paper on this several years ago, and one of the reviewers said, what you're suggesting is fine tuning the sledgehammer, and that's really not possible. So I think that it is an important part of evaluating where you are in the epidemic, trying to understand what proportion of people have been infected. As part of that, what proportion of them were asymptomatically infected before you start to lift the controls. So Adam Kucharski and colleagues at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine have published an estimate of really the vast proportion of the population in Wuhan still being susceptible. And so when they start to lift those controls, there is the risk of this resurgence.
There will be people out there, I'm sure, who are anxious about the idea of having to isolate themselves for a few months, as we heard, you know, very recently. This will be, you know, some of those most vulnerable with existing medical conditions and so on. But that is different to social distancing, right? The isolation they are being asked to do will be different than this.
So social distancing is quite a broad term, which includes many things. And so you could consider isolation of at-risk populations as a social distancing for them, but it does have a slightly different effect in that you're asking them to really prevent the severe cases through their own behaviour. And, you know, it's about quality of life as well as quantity of life. So it's really important to look after those people sort of psychosocially, as well as asking them to try and protect themselves. And of course, they're all very worried about the virus, but trying to change their behaviour to protect themselves, but also look after themselves more generally.
And on that note, finally, Deirdre, I mean, how do we retain our social relationships while we're social distancing? Have you got any tips or any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not an expert, but for example, I'm trying to set up a daily call with my colleagues, the people who work with me, you know, and we have a WhatsApp group where we don't talk about work. We only post silly things, like there was a cat video just posted. And you've got to maintain those social relationships because we are social beings. But at the same time, we also have to take on that individual responsibility, that social responsibility to change our behaviour to help the country manage this very serious situation. It really is going to be very tough over the next few months. And whilst it will be difficult for us to do the social distancing measures, particularly people who perhaps don't perceive themselves to be at risk, it's hard to underestimate the impact individual behaviour can have on this epidemic. You know, we really can slow the rate of transmission, but it does require a big change for us. And I also should note that that is not easy for everybody. And, you know, for example, I was talking to someone in the cafe where I work, and they're really concerned that they're going to lose their job because nobody's coming to the cafe. So it has huge social consequences. But it has to happen in order to slow down the rate of these cases arriving in our NHS hospitals.
Wonderful. Deirdre, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
We want to keep hearing your questions on the science behind the outbreak. Get in touch by filling in the form found at theguardian.com/COVID-19 questions, all one word. If you want to read, watch or listen to more coverage on the COVID-19 outbreak, make sure to head over to theguardian.com. And especially make sure to listen to our sister podcast, Today in Focus. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.